do us a favor, folks. Actually, it's more like doing a favor for our friends at America's Best Racing. They're not an official partner of the show, but they've supported us. We've supported them. They're friends. And they have this really cool thing, the Fan Choice Awards. And you can vote on it up till the 20th. So time is drawing near. You're going to want to do this sooner rather than later. Just by voting, you're automatically entered in a drawing to win a VIP trip to the Breeders' Cup along with a $10,000 bet. And here's the other thing. JK is nominated for Best Analyst in here. We, this podcast, is nominated in the sound category. Vote for us. That'd be great. But you don't have to vote for us. We want you to just go ahead and fill out one of these ballots anyway. AmericasBestRacing.net. You can navigate to it from there. And if you want to go directly, AmericasBestRacing.net/fan-choice-awards. Vote your conscience and have a little bit of fun while you do it. For 35 years, the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation has been dedicated to saving thoroughbred racehorses no longer able to compete on the racetrack from possible neglect, abuse, and slaughter. The oldest and largest charity in the U.S. devoted to racehorses, the TRF makes a promise of lifelong sanctuary to those horses unable to pursue a second athletic career. Unique within the aftercare industry, the horses of the TRF find their second chance in the role of teachers through the TRF Second Chances program, which provides vocational training in 7 correctional facilities across the U.S. The program is Saving Horses and Saving Lives. Learn more at www.trfinc.org, and please use the special In the Money podcast link to donate, trfinc.org/players. You're listening to the In the Money Players Podcast. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. This is show number 90. It is Monday, November 18th, 2019. And I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornatel, back with you from the Brooklyn Bunker once again. Muggsy the Handicapping Labrador alongside. She's deigned to join us for this show. She's been a little in and out lately. Her heart hasn't quite been in it since we left the place with the letters, I have to say. But she's here today, and we've got a couple other people here today to discuss what it has become a tradition. This is only the second year, but I think it's something we're going to want to do every year going forward, and that's to have a show where we talk about the plays in the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge. Those plays have been released. They're available on the Breeders' Cup website, and I just think they're an incredible learning tool. So I wanted to bring on two players who actually played in the contest to talk about their plays and see what can be learned. And I want to make it very clear, this is not an exercise in going through and just pointing out mistakes or making fun of anybody or doing anything like that.
The folks Yes, it is. That's exactly what we're going to do.
And that voice you just hear, letting himself, making himself aware before his introduction, but that's okay. And that is from the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation and a contest player himself, Pat Cummings. Pat, how are you this morning?
That wasn't me that just said that, but hello.
Oh, I'm getting my guests confused. That's what happens when you speak out of turn. I should probably go back and re-record that, but I'm gonna leave it in. All right. So the second voice you heard, Pat Cummings, Thoroughbred Idea Foundation. The first voice you heard, which you're about to hear again, he's coming at you from California. He is the one, the only. You love him, you hate him. You do some combination of the two. He's Benny South Street. Benny, what's going on, man?
Good morning to you both. Good to be with you.
I don't know how I confused your voices. I'm usually pretty good at that game. But as I was saying, one, you see some of the comments on Twitter, for example, and it's picking on people. And we're not here to pick on people. The publishing of these plays came about not as an educational tool, but as a transparency tool after the trouble in this contest a couple of years back. But I think we can take the fact that these plays are out there and use them to learn various lessons to make ourselves not just better contest players, but potentially also better bet writers. And we'll start off with a question for Pat, and I will ask him, when you look back at your own plays, is this a process that you typically do after a contest, after a day of wagering? How much time do you spend reflecting on how you played and looking to improve that for the future in a normal day? And how much of that have you done for this year's BCBC?
Well, hello, Pete. And yes, I think it's something that particularly for this contest, because you can get the printout, it really essentially is the only one that will give you after the fact. And I think it's something that maybe needs to be discussed about more in a future contest, that, that part of the lesson, part of the fun is going back and seeing what you did, how you did it, how you could do it better, how others did it better or worse. And I, you know, for those that are listening that may not normally kind of see my name on the contest ledger, it's mostly because in this contest in particular, I have played as a partner with Nick Tamaro for years and Philly Joe Metka. And Nick is normally kind of the lead guy, but congratulations to him. He just had his first child and was at home, very rightly so. And so I kind of took the lead this year, but you know, we've had plenty of success in this tournament in the past, fourth back in 2014, and we were 13th last year at Churchill, and we've had a couple blanks too. And this was the first year where we kind of, we kind of started strong and went out for a decent, little early run and then just floundered late on all of our stronger opinions. And we ended up actually basically just taking some money home because we didn't have a real strong opinion late in the day. And I mean, we'll get into that, but I have sat and looked at our plays and devised, you know, where we went wrong, where we should have pressed a little more. We actually made a mistake of confusing plays on the two different entries we had, and we should have had one on another. And the way in which we were arranging our plays, and that could have really cost us or just kind of caused some issues later. And it was kind of nice to be able to see that and identify that and try and make some adjustments for the future as we see fit.
For those wondering, the type of financial partnership Pat is describing, absolutely okay with the rules. What is not okay, according to the rules, is taking entries across different names and leveraging them against each other. That was what resulted in the disqualification 2 years ago, but it's absolutely fine to have financial interests in different entries as long as you don't play them in what is deemed to be a collusive manner. Let me send it to you, Benny. How often do you go back and look at your plays after a tournament to try to learn something?
Yeah, I do it actually while the contest is going on. But I think if you're not introspective and you're not looking back at yourself and assessing your own plays, you're not getting any better. This contest for me was what I had hoped it would be, in that I got to my horse. I think you probably remember I wasn't willing to give him out over the airwaves.
Oh yes, I got some letters about that.
I did get to my horse. I was hoping I would get to over 20 plus thousand collectively between both of my entries, and I was able to do that. And I took a swing with Higher Power. I had a pretty sizable double from Bricks and Mortar and also from Old Persian to several in the last, a few that I wanted to cover. And I got there, just the horse that I had played wasn't good enough. Actually, had he not freaked out in the gate when the crowd went nuts beforehand and broke the field, I think the outcome may have been a little bit different. So he's still on my watch list. But to answer your question, absolutely, you have to go back and look. And I go back and look at other people's as well. Which brings up the point that you made earlier about this being, originally this was about transparency to make sure there was no collusion. I would actually like to see this go away, to be honest with you. I don't think it's fair. And because Tony Zhao is watching, I know he's going to code everybody, including me. And Pat and Nick, we can laugh. I'm telling you, he's going to go through and look at these and decide what people are doing and potentially beat them later. I don't have that luxury. I think it puts me at a little bit of a disadvantage, but just one guy's opinion. I think if the oversight committee, whoever that is, if it's Tim Schramm and his team, if they go through and look at these, I think that's one thing, but it's become merely a information grab for competitors to look at one another. And I think that only makes it an advantage for probably a few players.
Pat,
if I was on that list, that'd be great. I'd have no problem with it, but I'm not.
Pat, I know you're going to agree with me on this one, that the benefits of releasing the plays far outweigh the fear that Benny has, but I'm going to let you speak to it because I imagine you'll say it better than me. The data and the releasing of this data is something I know you've been a proponent of from the beginning.
Yeah, I think the benefits of transparency are incredibly strong, and really that applies to so many different things in our sport. And it is unusual to be able to see a segment of bets of any type in any sort of capacity. I mean, you know, we're never going to see this on an ordinary Tuesday. I guess you could argue that the TRPB sees this somewhat to some degree and sees how those markets are there. And I would go so far as to say that we don't hear enough from them as the as kind of the watchdog on the betting side of things. And then maybe we should hear a little bit more from them, particularly in regards to things like the Derby Superfecta and putting our minds at ease and things like that. But I think the point, I actually, when I was reviewing the plays, I was thinking about that, what Benny was suggesting. The one thing, though, that I think maybe you can't necessarily model is how the player who is not using some sort of system is going to, how they're actually going to come to their decision as to how they'll bet their final race. So that at the end of the day, if all of the players are operating essentially as someone like Tony would suggest probably is inefficient, it's very difficult to model inefficient behavior when there are so many potential variables that go into the equation, which are very difficult to kind of nail down into an efficient dialogue. And I think that that's, you know, that there is the concern, I think, is a well-founded one. But it would be if our overall market and performances were efficient, if all of the players were operating off of systems or programs, then that I think would be easier. But when you have a lot of people who aren't, and for example, if you listen to the way Brad Anderson was discussing his winning plays, that would be, I think, pretty difficult to model and to play against. And then I think almost it leads into a separate conversation, which is, are you then playing to win yourself or simply playing to be an alternate result? Are you playing not to lose, or are you simply just trying to play against the way other players have not made their decisions? And it gets a little maybe counterintuitive at times. But the only reason we're having this discussion is because the plays are out there, and I think that's kind of what makes it fun, particularly for this tournament, which is around our sports championship event, kind of our season-ending championship. And it really offers a lot of kind of unique insight that is very rare for horse players to have. And that's what I think makes it pretty engaging.
I would come back at Benny and just say, look, it's a two-way street. How valuable is it to get to see somebody like Tony and how he approaches a tournament like this? Somebody like a Christian Helmers, who, you know, say what you will about Christian Helmers, and God knows I have. But I appreciate the opportunity to see somebody who has had such success in these live bankroll tournaments and see what he does and see his approach to wagering as something that I might learn from. I just think, I mean, I get what you're saying, but you don't, if you're so worried about that, to me, a much better solution isn't don't publish the plays. It's okay. So maybe if you're so worried about that, then don't play in this tournament. And here's
why I'm going to stick to my guns on this one. Please. I can quip about Tony all day, but if I am a better player, and of course, you know me as narcissist Benny, of course, I think I'm a better player. I don't want people knowing my game theory and my strategy and how I get to a certain number. And I think the better players, which there's a learning curve, right? So it's taken It's taken most of these guys a very long time to get to where they're at. For them to just turn that over and to have somebody learn that potentially quickly if they really want to, and then offer this possibility up to beat that player, I think is a mistake.
Well, what do you see in your plays? This is a very on-the-nose question that I didn't prep you for because I didn't know the conversation was going to go here, but I'm going to try it. We can always cut it out later if this goes nowhere. But looking at your plays from the BCBC, what are you afraid somebody's going to – what did you do that was so clever to preserve bankroll? I mean, it sounds to me like the strategy you performed was one that's like I thought of the second time I thought of – what a strategy might be in a live bankroll contest, preserve to your strongest opinion and fire. What's somebody going to see in your plays that puts you at such a competitive advantage the next time?
Not me. I don't think I'm that clever. But somebody at Nissan's plays, I think one can.
Well, let's talk about that. What do you see in there that you feel like is potentially deleterious to Nissan Gebe, former BCBC champion going forward when you look at his plays in the 2019 tournament? I had him on my list, but honestly, I had him on my list of something that I would point out that I would never do, not something that I would do. But we'll start with what you see there that you feel like was maybe giving something away.
Well, there's a lot that you can glean from his plays. He's very efficient. He doesn't play a lot of races. He dutches practically everything, exactas, tries, doubles. It's obvious when he's trying to play through a race and just get through with his capital. And then you can see his strongest plays. And he was correct on those, and that's what got him to where he needed to go. I totally agree with you. I think he laid an egg late, but we'll never know because we'll never be able to talk to him about why he didn't do what he should have done, in my opinion.
Well, let's explain. I want to just back up for listeners. Not everybody listening is like super familiar with all this stuff. So when you talk about dutching bets, define what that means.
Well, he's playing specific numbers, in a way that no matter what the outcome was, for example, he might play an exacta that he's got, or here's a good example. I'm looking at his plays right now. He's got a try where he played $50, 145, $10, 185, $20, 148, $10, 184. He clearly likes the one on the one on top, and he's dutching, meaning equally playing those bottom three horses equally. So if the one wins and the four, the five, and the eight run second and third, he's going to win probably an equal amount of money no matter what the outcome is on the bottom of that bet. So his plays are riddled with Dutch plays. I actually, to be honest with you, I prefer to play the exact opposite way of that, which is if a more likely winner wins, i.e. the favorite, I get my money back. But if the longer price on my opinion wins, I bury it so that, you know, I'm hoping that a longer price wins. Not only do I crush that play, but I pass a lot of people because they're playing efficiently in kind of this Dutch manner that Nissan does. You know, that's my own strategy, but
what accounts for Nissan's the difference? You feel like his version is more of the common wisdom, so you're trying to do something a little bit different to gain equity versus the field? Is that where your idea of trying to? Okay.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of times I might like that longer price more than I like the favorite anyway.
Well, in that case,
why would I play them equally? That just doesn't make any sense for me.
I mean, when it comes to bet writing, for me, the best line about it I've ever heard, and probably not surprisingly, comes from Mike Maloney, which is that when you write a bet, you're basically trying to express your opinion in that bet. So to me, if you think the market has it right and those shorter prices are more likely, the way that Nissan is doing it makes the most sense. Whereas if you feel like the crowd is wrong and you like those longer numbers equal to the shorter numbers, the way you're describing makes sense. I don't want to leave this idea of Nissan's play at the end, but I also want to bring Pat back in. Pat, I'm sure you've noticed this. What struck me as so strange and reading between the lines, I think Benny agrees with me, is why somebody who is playing for a $1 million bonus at the end of the tournament would just take that $40,000 and leave it in his pocket. Any wager he made in that last race, pretty much any wager, his dollar would have been worth more than a dollar with the extra equity, not only in just the normal over $1 million in the prize pool, but then the additional $1 million of the bonus. I just found it absolutely befuddling that he chose to sit on his money there. Had you noticed that, Pat? Can you come up with any reason why that might have made sense, or are you as confused as we are?
To a degree, Pete, yes. But before you even kind of look at where he ends up in the Classic, I think you have to focus a little bit on basically the way he was playing beforehand. And all credit to him, basically his strongest opinion leading up to that point certainly seemed to be Uni to win the Breeders' Cup Mile. And he connected with a big straight double, Mattioli into Uni. And then all of his try plays in the mile were basically Uni on top, with a huge focus of got Stormy in second, and then two or three horses to run third, of which Without Parole was one of them. So basically leading into the mile and then hitting the mile individually, he pulled out roughly $71,000 straight away there to get in a position to bet the last three races pretty big and really focus on that bonus. But when it comes to it, in the Classic itself, and his plays probably stick out most of all of anybody because there were so many of them and they were so efficiently structured that you look at it and you say, it's hard to believe that someone bet $21,000 in almost exclusively trifectas, maybe $15,000, $16,000 in tries, and did not connect Vino Rosso and McKenzie when those two horses did factor in some of his plays. So when you had 70,000 roughly going into the race, bet 21,000, it was, with a $1 million bonus on the line, it felt like there's just a huge question out there as to why not go farther. Clearly he had the money to do so, and he had the structure and the kind of the edge behind him in terms of playing and the way in which he was playing. And it didn't come to be that those two horses were never connected on any of his plays and he missed. Now, look, he still walked away with a nice chunk of change, but it probably was a personal disappointment for him in this particular iteration of the contest.
Let's talk about the winner, Brad Anderson. I was really impressed for especially someone who describes himself as a rookie player, not totally a rookie. He's played in a few contests before, but to get in the position he was in, where not only was he alive to Vino Rosso, not only, as he described on the show when he appeared last week, not only did he make the very interesting and ultimately fortunate decision to get off McKenzie. McKenzie was his top pick, but rather than mess around with McKenzie exactas when the win bet on McKenzie wasn't going to get him there, instead of going McKenzie exactas, decided to spin McKenzie for Vino Rosso to keep the simplicity of the win bet. That worked out great, but he was also alive on his other ticket to three other horses who would have gotten him very, very close to the win based on doubles he'd played on his second entry. I just wonder if many players in the history of the tournament have ever been so thickly alive to four runners in the Classic to win the thing. I thought it was a clinic of managing risk and reward and betting efficiency, and I was super impressed. What did you think when you look back at the winner's plays, Benny?
Super impressive. I don't think I could ever do what he did and completely flip-flop, although I didn't realize that he had another ticket and he had other that he had other options to potentially get there. Who were those runners, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, if you have the plays in front of you, you could probably find it quicker than I could. But I think they were. You've got it, Pat.
Got
I think they were the next logical horses, honestly. But what, Pat? Who were they exactly?
Yeah. So we obviously know on his main ticket he bet $25,000 or so on Vino Rosso, but on his other entry he was alive to War of Will for $130,000, to Yoshida for $106,000 and to Higher Power for about $97,000.
Oh, I would have barely beat him. That would have been great.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
Not too many people would have the stones to do what he did. I mean, if I liked McKenzie and I was willing to put however much he was willing to put on him, $25,000 approximately, I would absolutely start looking for Exactus. But he didn't do that. Huge kudos to him. Unbelievable decision. That's game theory expertise, if you ask me. I don't see many people doing that. I know a lot of sharp guys that are in this thing, and I don't see any of them doing what he did.
To me, it's the difference between playing the horses the way that you would typically play the horses and really playing the game within the game. Another quote that I love about contests comes from a master contest player himself, Dave Gutfreund, where he says that these contests are just games with numbers. And to me, that decision to go off McKenzie in favor of Vino Rosso, that shows playing that game within the game to a level that was beyond his experience in these contests. Shows, and he comes from looking at his professional background. He's somebody with a very analytical mind, and he put it to good use in this year's BCBC. Pat, anything else to unpack from Brad Anderson's plays before we move the discussion along?
I listened to the show, Pete, in advance of our show here, and I wanted to really kind of get an understanding of what his mindset was. And as you, I think, rightly pointed out, and as he asserted, he does consider, this is a newer thing for him in terms of the contest. And there were some elements, I think, of his play that showed that very clearly. For example, he loves Covfefe. And he goes all in, essentially, on Covfefe in his first play on Saturday. And he bet in a way that I think really limited his opportunity to make as much money from this clearly strong opinion by betting $1,900 to win on Covfefe and then spending his remaining $3,400 on doubles. If he had taken that $1,900 to win on Covfefe, which only earned him $4,750, if he had taken that $1,900 and spread that in doubles as he did with his other $3,400, he walks out of the race with a lot more money than he had. So if he was going to go all in on Covfefe in some capacity, it probably would have been worth it to focus all of that money on the doubles as opposed to betting $1,900 to win $4,700 to win. The end result's the same. He's at zero if Covfefe doesn't win. So why would you limit your return on the win line when you could maximize it and turn Covfefe's, 2-1, 5-2 into something much, much more substantial?
And yeah, I would disagree with this.
All right. I was going to say my guess to the strategy, and we'll see, Benny, what you think. My thought was, Pat, that he was making that win bet so if he blew in the second leg, he'd be basically where he started and have a chance to make some other play somewhere. It spoke to me that maybe the opinion on Covfefe was just that much stronger.
He bet Covfefe to all. So he was guaranteeing himself that if Covfefe wins, he's going to hit the double.
I see what you're saying. So in that instance, if you're playing the all, you're basically trading the takeout in one pool for another. And was it a weighted all though, right? Or was it a...
No, it wasn't. And that's another thing that is, interesting to me. He bet a $200 double Covfefe all, and then he bet a $250 double Covfefe to four horses, including Belvoir Bay. So overall, he invested $3,400 in the double pool, and he walked away with just over $18,000. Whereas he bet another $1,900 in the win pool and walked away with $4,750. So he probably just reduced his overall return on the race by spreading that money across the two different pools, one of which was going to give him a lower return almost regardless, just being the Hurst short win price.
That's an interesting point.
I'm not saying it changed the outcome of the contest, but it did give him a little less money to necessarily fire with.
Well, the irony, and, Pat, you realize the irony, as you're talking about it, it's kind of hilarious because it may have changed the contest. Because if he'd had more money going into the Classic, he plays McKenzie and we ain't talking about him here. So it may be it may be a really funny situation where maybe betting a little bit inefficiently there ends up paying off. But Benny, you seem to have a strong opinion about this. Or does the fact that was a double to all change what you were going to say initially?
Well, right. So this is the luxury of hindsight, right? So he got a bomb home in the second leg. If a favorite wins, we could easily say, well, that was a bad double play. He didn't have a strong opinion. Who plays a 3-2 shot over all in a double and expects to turn a better profit than just 3-2? So you could easily argue he should have put it all to win had the favorite won the second leg. So this is just luxury of hindsight. That's all this is, in my opinion. He had the right horse, and this is how people win contests, is they fall into some luck. He had an opinion that was a good one in the second leg, which was he didn't like the favorite. You could also argue he should have maybe started doubles in that race with all and gone to a different – I don't remember who won the next leg, but, you know, if you think a price is going to win that second leg of the Covfefe double, then why not start doubles there as opposed to end while starting with a 3-2 shot? But, yeah, that's my only take is we have the luxury of hindsight, and – it's easy to say, well, this was a mistake. I think we'd all have plays like that based on the outcome of odds and specific races.
It pains me to say this, but when we spoke, I don't think this actually made the show, or maybe I even edited it out because I didn't want his head to swell to the size of a basketball. But Brad did specifically credit JK with the rationale for pressing Belvoir Bay as a horse that JK had talked about liking on the Final Answer show. And then
fantastic.
And then I'm sure it didn't hurt at all that everything Peter Miller sent out for the 2 days, with the exception of the horse on the dirt in the previous Breeders' Cup race, had been running 5 to 10 points higher than you would have thought they would have run. I'm sure that didn't hurt for the reason to press Belvoir Bay. But let's move on from the winner's place. There's so much different stuff to unpack here. I have a bunch of specific questions for you, but before we drill down into those, I want to ask you guys more open-ended questions, and I'll start with you, Pat, just about a player whose play surprised you in one way or another. Just completely open-ended to opportunity to talk about one of the players who interested you at this year's BCBC.
I think there's a lot that you can glean from people who've had bad contests and are still trying to put themselves in a position to win. And two kind of longtime contest players and just sharp guys in general. I've never met Mike Mulvihill. I obviously know his brother pretty well, Jim, but Mike played very well.
It might be a different Mike Mulvihill, actually. It might, Pat. It's not really important, but there are two Mike Mulvihills who've played in contests. I think this might be the Chicago one, not the one who works for Fox. But it's not important for the point of it. I just wanted to throw that out there as a point of fact.
Truly a small world if that's the case. But anyway, Mike Mulvihill in this contest did not play. He did not have much success during most of the contest, and he's left with a small bullet to fire going into the Classic, and he had a $1,000 exact of Vino Rosso over Seeking the Soul. And if he hits it, it's $187,000. He had a very little bit of money. He took one shot to make sure that if he was really right, he slams it. And I just like that sort of play from someone who is, you know, I'm down to the end, and this is my only chance to get something, and making that bold play and knowing that this is my chance to win the contest. Frank Mastari basically did the same thing. He had a $1,500 exact of Vino Rosso over War of Will. That would have gotten them $147,000. So I like that sort of, you know, guys who just stick with it and stay true to their way. And you know, when it came down to it, they still made plays that could get them a substantial score if needed. Now, there's lots of people that you can kind of look at and say, wow, you know, clearly these people were setting up their tournament to get to maximize a single opinion. And the one gentleman that fit that for me was a fellow named David Frohart Lane. He had two entries, bet nothing but $600 a race in basically the win, place, and show pools up until the Classic, and was dinking and dunking his way along. And all he did was bet all of one entry on Owendale to win, and another was McKinsey, Urbino, Rosso over Owendale and Monster Exactus. And if he had hit on the Vino Rosso Owendale, $200,000 and wins the contest.
The old chip in a chair mentality, really. I do exactly. Love that. And it's funny. I was having an argument in a text conversation with Tommy Massis about this, who was saying, I was saying that there is this value to just preserve bankroll, take your one shot at the end when you know where you need to get. And I think, Pat, you just gave several great examples of that. And, you know, Tommy was saying it's just, and maybe Tommy's right, that there are so many people doing that it's not a great strategy in 2019 to just try to save and shoot once. But it might not be the best strategy. I certainly think the three-stage strategy that Brad Anderson used to go to that last race with more money and be able to bet much more simply than having to hit a cold number. I think we're going to see a lot more of that going forward. But there's still some value to having even just your basic bullets left to fire and doing so in an efficient way. Benny, what do you think about that idea? Where are we in 2019? Is it a good idea to just try to preserve initial bankroll and take one shot in one of the last two races at the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge?
It'll always be a good strategy. I'm not sure it's going to be the best moving forward, but it'll always be a good one because you've got a target and you know what number you're trying to hit. But you know, the question that you had posed earlier, which player have you recognized that you really like those plays? I don't have one in particular, but there are a couple dozen guys or more that swung hard and early in this contest. And that takes a lot of guts. And I think we're going to start to see one of these guys hit early. I know every once in a while it happens, but I wouldn't be surprised moving forward because that's kind of the opposite of what everybody is doing. I know I waited until the end. You know, I wanted to see that target. And I think probably 80 to 90% of the guys that were in the contest that had the bullets to make a shove late, I think that's they all shared that same opinion. But these guys that swung early, These guys are dangerous. I mean, they're willing to lose all their money on the drop of a hat. It takes a lot of courage to do that. I'm not one. Even if I had a strong opinion, I think looking introspectively at my own plays, I did have some stronger opinions early, but I didn't play them in a way that would have allowed me to bottom out the field or put me, you know, in the top five had I connected. And I think there are probably a lot of guys that could say the same thing where, hey, you hit some races. I mean, I'm looking at my second day. I had both Peter Millers. I had Matoli. I had Blue Prize. And, you know, I was barely up $8,000 or $9,000 going into that last race where if I had the courage to do what some of these guys did at the very bottom of the leaderboard, they're on the negative because they didn't even meet the minimums. Those guys are dangerous to me, and it's something I'm going to start to look to do in the future.
I think it's a great point that Benny brings up, that these guys will hit. These examples that are out there, you know, a lot of them seem to miss this year when you start going through some of those, but those guys will hit from time to time. You know, one horse that seemed like he was really key for a lot of those types of players was Decorated Invader, who seemed like he was a real strong push for a couple of real pros who were playing the contest early. And you know, he had a bit of a rough trip. I would be remiss though, if I didn't add one more impressive player to this, and that was Robert Trainer, because Robert Trainer's Friday was about as perfect as you could find. He had two entries, and on both of the entries, he connected big on his first three plays. But basically before midway point or after the midway point of the card, after the juvenile turf sprint and the juvenile turf itself, Robert Trainer had two entries that were clear way out in front of everybody else. He was on fire. He had a straight $500 double on the undercard. He had 650 to win on the horse that won the race prior to the juvenile turf sprint, whose name escapes me. And he absolutely cold decked the four-wheel drive Structure double on both of his plays. I mean, literally on his second ticket, he hits a pretty cold double, a one over two horses for 13 grand. He hits another double, one over two horses for 17, almost 18 grand. And then he cold decks four-wheel drive Instructor. I mean, it was some of the most efficient, successful play. It's the sort of start that you dream of in these contests, to be very tight, very focused, and just slam it early. He did that. And then after that, did not do much. He got himself into position, obviously. And then on Saturday, he bet 20,000 a win on Bricks and Mortar, which doubled him up to 40 grand, and then whiffed on the classic on a $10,000 play. But it's the sort of thing that shows you that Friday doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot in this contest. It's really all what comes to Saturday. And if you go through the top 15 players in the cash positions, Friday did not mean a lot. In the grand scheme of things, it was really all about what happened on Saturday.
There's that great simulation that Robin Howlett made that you can find on Twitter. I retweeted it at some point. Maybe we'll retweet it again in conjunction with this show. But it speaks to your point exactly, Pat, of how much of the movement happened late. Since you mentioned Trainer, another former Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge champion, the champs, I don't mind as much like quibbling into their play. I don't feel like I'm taking any not punching down talking about these champs. Everybody knows they're great players, and I'm certainly not looking to criticize Trainer at all. But looking over his plays on day two, it didn't seem to me that he used the leverage that he had built up from Friday at all. He seems like somebody who's very comfortable betting a lot of money, and he's just betting what he's going to bet based on his opinion in the race. He didn't seem, and this is where the quibble comes in, didn't seem to me like somebody really like playing the game within the game to use that leverage to get the extra equity out of the prize pool. That's the way I interpreted it anyway. And the point came up before about from Benny about players landing on zero. And that reminded me of an old Maury Wolf quote about how you can sometimes tell the strength of the contest field, not by looking at the names at the top of the leaderboard, but the names at the bottom and the people who are willing to go to zero. And the more people who are willing to go to zero, very often, the more strong that contest field actually is. And we did see plenty of that. And I would imagine we're going to continue to see players in this contest looking to do that multi-stage strategy. And one player who tried to do that, our own Jonathan Kinchin. And it was interesting. We had a great chat the other day at the end of the show. My initial thought was that maybe it was too aggressive what he did. And for those who don't remember, he went all in both entries, Dennis's Moment. So he bottomed out in the final race on Friday. And my initial thought was, with as little as the Friday seemed to mean, to the point that Pat was making, that maybe knowing that he'd had a whole bunch of winners on Saturday, I was originally thinking, hey, he might have won the contest even without turning the 15,000 into 30,000 that he was trying to do. And I'm using round numbers here, and I know they're not dead on, but follow me for the sake of the argument. But as he went through and talked about what his opinions were, and while he had winners, they were races where he might have needed to go three deep. And he kind of convinced me that he made the right move trying to double up his bankroll on the end of day one, even with a shorty. Benny, what did you think of how JK played this one?
Well, I think I had a couple people block me on Twitter because I was defending his actions on Friday.
Anyone who would block you over that is not somebody that you want, reading your communications anyway. So I say block them. DM them a couple of choice words and then block them. That's what I try not to
block anybody. I'm too argumentative to block people. I'm on the fence. I used to be staunchly opposed to this kind of play or game theory. I still kind of lean that way. I think he should maybe do it in the middle. He seems to do it on both entries. And, you know, a buddy of mine, Frank Scatone, says, you know, if you're consistently losing and you do the same thing every time, that's called insanity, right? So he's had a bad pattern of going down in flames with odds on. So with two entries, I don't necessarily disagree with Jonathan. I know I don't agree, but why not play one of those entries, right? So one of them is going to move up, and the other one can stand pat. Then we have a little bit of insurance. You know, it's debatable. My whole deal is I don't want to lose everything on a play that is not going to put me within one bet of winning. And I'm not so sure, and I can't speak for Jonathan, you'd have to ask him, but I don't know what his big play would have been after that if he was planning on going for it.
I think he would have needed two more. I think he would have needed two more all-in Dutch doubles, and I think he would have hit him. And I think starting with 30, you know, 28 rather than 15 was probably the difference between him being able to win with two more all-in Dutch doubles and not. So, I think he played it right.
So two plays for me is too much. Yeah. It's too much.
But that's just your gambling personality.
Too many bad things can happen.
That just comes down to gambling personality, though, you know.
And
I don't like your idea, actually, of going all in on one. To me, that's weird. One foot on the boat, one foot on the dock stuff. I mean, if it's your strong opinion, if you feel like your dollar's worth more than a dollar in that pool, which he did with the antipathy we both had sort of developed for eight rings by post time. I mean, he convinced me that it made perfect sense in that chat we had on the show the other day. But I mean, I take your point about gambling personality for sure. It's not for everybody. Pat, what do you make of the going? It doesn't have to specifically be about JK's play, but just this whole idea of trying to double up your bet on day one. Is it a strategy that appeals to you, or do you think it's too risky?
Look, in terms of knowing that you can be alive late in the day, having done very little and still have some shots, and if you're willing to go to zero and you want to get down there and you have an opinion to get to take a shot and maybe make an extra 300, 200, 100 grand in prize money, I think it's tough to be 100% right multiple times. And I think that's the position that JK was putting himself in there. The other thing that sticks out to me is that unless you're talking about the classic, very few people got themselves into position only on the win line early, you know, in the course of this tournament. And you just have to stake so much of your balance to make a big score on the win line that unless you have a massive bankroll to really kick in with, I question the approach a little bit. It will work for you sometimes, but I agree 100% with what Benny said, which is when you do that at that point in the tournament, my thought is, what are my moves after that? If I'm only betting, you know, $10,000-$12,000 on a short priced favorite, if I win that, then how am I going to proceed through the course of the tournament? It's a big move. It's full of risk and frankly, not a ton of return by having to stake your entire bankroll on a strong opinion. It certainly isn't the way that I or my partners have played, in these sorts of contests, but you know, you can look at the way in which we played and come up with plenty of different critical elements too. So, again, I'm not 100% for it. I'm not 100% against it. It certainly isn't the way that I would be doing it, but it does lead a lot of other questions, which I'm sure JK can answer, which is what's your strategy after you hit that?
I mean, I would have thought I can pretty much answer from the conversation the other day. I think he'd have been looking at doing a couple of 3x3 or 4x2 all in doubles on the next day, each one looking for, you wouldn't need much. You might even be able to put more horses in, but basically to Dutch your money all in the double pool to look to double up again. So 30, you hit one double, that 30 becomes 60. You hit one more, the 60 becomes 120, and you potentially win the whole thing. I think that's the theory anyway.
You take all the risk in the hopes that you are very close to being perfectly right, maybe two or three times throughout the contest.
I don't know that I'd call hitting a 3x3 double being perfectly right, though. I mean, that's a bet that I think if you said I only had to do that three times in the Breeders' Cup to be right on a 3x3 double, I mean, I'm even money, if not better, to do that on a 3x3 double. I mean, I think.
I look at the actual top 15 finishers in the contest this year. Just look at them straight away. 9 of the top 15 only got into that position because they had a bullet left in the Classic. They fired and they hit it. And there was only one player in the top of those 9 who merely improved his position otherwise. So, you know, the numbers are suggesting, and you go back and you look at past history, that you need to be typically around and playing in the Classic or having some bullets to fire at the end and hitting in the last race to be able to put yourself into a money position. So, you know, you look at like Dick Girardi, he did, of course, the right thing by sitting there, sitting pat and say, come and catch me here in the last race. I'm not going to play. He hits that monster exact at Bricks and Mortar United. I just think you need to make sure that you are alive to get into the Classic, because plenty of people who have had ordinary tournaments up to that point are still sitting with extra cash at the end because they had a bullet and they hit it. And you know, that's why I maybe just sort of question the thought that I'm going to hit two or three big ones along the way, but putting everything on the line to get to that point.
It works for JK. Look, I've seen him win contests like this where he's doubling up on doubles and he gets there. It's just not for me. I'm not willing to put my tournament life at stake based on a horse breaking bad, which is what happened. There's just too many ways to lose in this game for me. But Pete, you had mentioned a 3x3 double and even money. 3x3 doubles got to pay $36 to double up. So that is not exactly the easiest double to hit. That means you're removing favorites from those doubles.
Not necessarily. So, you could, if you have enough money on your bankroll, you Dutch to create the leverage where you can still have that favorite combination because you're having, you know, a $260 double one way and a $48 double another way. You see what I'm saying?
No, I do, but it's still got to pay. You know, if you're investing $18 on average, right? So if you go 3x3, that's an $18 double for $2, right? So you still have to get to a $36 average. So even if you pound one more than another, it's still got, the numbers don't lie. You've still got to get to that number, right? Which is 18-1. If it's 9-1, you still got to get to 18.
I'd have no problem doing it 3 times throughout the whole of the Breeders' Cup. I could pretty much guarantee you that.
Okay, so this my next point. If that's the case and that's the position, historically, you could look at doubles like this and say, how many of them did you hit? Let's say you've played 20. How many have you hit? I would bet it would be way less than half. Now, only JK can answer that because I'm not out here playing doubles like that, but my guess would be that less than half the time those are going to come to fruition. And look, Jonathan, for people that out there that don't know, he was one winner away from probably taking down the BCBC last year.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
He did it
he had half
in
the
similar
field.
Fashion. And but that was, again, that was one where he didn't have the favorite and he dutched it and he played it correctly and he still got beat. But it was, you know, he was on the goal line going in and he had 4 horses and just didn't like accelerate, you know, so it works for him. It's just not something I'm going to do. And one of the reasons why is there are just too many people out there that are willing to hammer things and win with one shot. And to Pat's point, having to be correct 3 times versus one or two, it's hard to outgain those people. And 120,000 was a bad target anyway. I targeted that through my double, and I figured I would be top five. I actually was surprised to end up at 145. I was thinking it would probably be a little bit higher than that. But you know, as it was, 120 would have got you fifth. 121 was fourth. So,
well, that's a fair point about the all-in double on the end. The all-in double on the end is tricky because then you don't have a play in that last race. One quick follow-up on that, and then I really want to move this along because I got a couple other things on my list I want to get to, and we've only got like 15 minutes max left today, which is, I take your point about how many times you're right, you know, if you're right half the time in that situation. But you can be right, because it's a contest, you can be right a little bit less, considerably less, really, than you need to be to make that a good play in real life, because you're playing in such a manner that you're participating in the prize pool, which negates and changes the whole concept of what takeout is. Especially in this Breeders' Cup betting challenge. Because for me, I mean, I look through these plays, and I'm not going to knock anybody specific here, but there were 450 entries or whatever. It's not like I've been through every one, but I'm going to estimate that maybe 50 to 75 players played in a manner that gave them a chance to win the tournament. Am I going too low with that number, Pat?
I don't think so, and I think it's worth explaining my own play a little bit to answer that question. We, Nick and I and Joe, it's kind of funny. I mean, we just didn't have a strong opinion in the Classic. Our biggest opinions of the 2 days were to connect Dunbar Road into Anthony Van Dyke or Old Persian. And at the time we placed our big double bets in the distaff, and we really, I mean, we loved Dunbar Road in that spot and singled her. You know, those doubles were returning about $100,000. And we said, let's get ourselves into that position and swing big here, because we don't know if anything we do in the Classic is necessarily going to be right, because we just didn't have a big opinion. And that's trouble in this contest, to not have a strong opinion in the last race. So we were trying to get there and put ourselves in a position to win added money earlier than that. And, you know, that's just a little bit like Dick Girardi, which is, I think his position was more focused on let me maximize a clear opinion that they had in the turf that will put us in a position to win the contest. And he took that and did it. And sure enough, he got caught in the end. But when you're strategizing this tournament in advance, I think you have to look and say, where is my chance to win based on my opinion? And there are plenty of players. There's a lot of players in this contest, and you can easily go back and look at it, who just aren't taking anywhere near the chances they need to make the added money. It's not so much about the bankroll. It's the free money there that's at the end too, and you have to be looking to figure that out. So when it came down to it, not having a huge opinion, we basically said, let's bet about $6,000 worth of exactas, try and connect on one of them. If you look and you see the way our opinion was, we Dutched exactas in the Seeking the Soul in Owendale using five of the logical horses who end up running 1, 2, 3 among them. But, you know, we just didn't connect, and it wasn't our strongest opinion. We took that shot before, and we missed it, so we sort of just dinked our way to try and see if we could get a shot for some added money. There are some players who clearly had that clear opinion and were able to maximize it, or at least give themselves a shot to make a big win on the final race, which is really kind of important to this.
No doubt. Pat, how much did you leave on your bankroll?
We left with $10,000.
I mean, enough to get almost two entries at the Pegasus contest. I mean, is that, with your group as an ongoing concern, is that part of the theory? Is, you know what, we can free roll in another contest where maybe we'll love the last race and be much more willing to push all in at the end? Does that factor into it at all?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not just about today. And we said to ourselves, we do not have a good enough gambling opinion. It was almost like Steve Crist's opinion on the pick six. I look at it and look at it and look at it. And at the end of the day, you just have to say, I don't have a strong enough opinion to bet $17,000 on this race, and it would be foolish for us to do so just because we'll live to fight another day in another contest. And to be fair, Nick, Joe, and I, in our partnership, we started last year in the BCBC and basically kind of free rolled and dinked and dunked our way through the course of the year, and basically never had to put up any money for other contests. You know, having done very well in the Pegasus and the Belmont Challenge and whatnot. So
I get it.
It worked out well to get to that point.
It suits your gambling personalities. You could make a counter argument, but if you'd bet that 10, just in terms of EV, you would expect to get back more than a dollar for those $10,000 you could have bet on the end. But it's the whole world, and this is some guys, even really sharp guys on Twitter, don't seem to understand. Like, there's more to life than EV. There's a big picture of life and what your business plan is, and it's not just all about pushing in your money every time you have the opportunity for it to be worth more than a dollar. So I get what you're saying, and I get the counterargument, but I think at the end of the day, you did what's right for you. Benny, what percentage of this field has a chance to win in the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge?
Your estimate's probably accurate. To be honest with you, I haven't looked as thorough through this list of players and all of their plays as Pat. I do think the number is going to go up every year. Guys they see the value in the contest. They can partner up with one another. In fact, I wish there was an element to where you could, if they had some sort of like sharing opportunity, right? So if you got 10 guys together and they each ponied up 1,000, that would be the way to do it. Give one guy the power to make the plays. And then we would certainly see some obnoxious scores. I've always said, if you're not playing with your own money, you have the best chance to have the highest score. And even with my play, I loved the classic. I loved Higher Power. And I still had a hard time pulling the trigger enough to win. And I wouldn't have won. I think I would have ended up with less than 105,000 had Higher Power won. But I'm married. I have to come home with something. If I zero out from 23,000, I'm probably signing papers the next day. I'm certainly in an attorney's office in a bad situation. So,
God.
I had like 23 or 24. I played 13, and it was enough for me. My ego is big, but it's not big enough to where I had to win. If I can finish top five and make an extra, I don't know what fifth is worth. I'm guessing it's got to be worth $70,000 or $100,000.
Somewhere in there.
You know, that's enough for me. But yeah, the list of guys is probably short, but I do believe that it's going to get bigger and bigger as people learn how to go about turning a small bankroll into a big one. I mean, the BCBC, the number of times you need to multiply your bankroll to win, it's higher than most contests, right? You can play in a small contest and it's a $500 buy-in. And let's say you're starting with $500, and if you get 12x your money, chances of you winning that contest are pretty good. You know, if you go from 500 to 6,000, you're going to be right there. You know, this is 15 times easy almost every year, which is hard. I mean, that's a lot of money. And you've got a lot of people that ended up having at least their bankroll or more at the end, dozens of people. So
there's a dirty little secret to address though, Benny, which is the idea of that is correct. I mean, if you take 140 and you divide it by 7,500, let's see if PTF.
Am I failing at math?
No, you're good. So this year, when you do that math, it's 18.6. But when you think about having two entries and you take that same 140,000 and you divide it by 15,000, you're only looking at 9.3. And I think that's the way that a lot of winners, this year's winner certainly approached it that way. And we've seen that before. I mean, I believe it is an outsized edge to have the two entries. And I get why it's done. But I think for starters, if you're serious about not just placing high up like either of your stated goals were in this tournament, but winning the thing, you know, starting with a lesson I get looking at these plays is that you want to start with two. It's that added powder in this format is worth, again, sort of
a lot of money to start with.
Yeah, I mean,
15,000.
You know,
I don't know how many people go to the track on a weekend and start with 15 grand. It's a lot of money to put out there. I mean, we're gamblers. We play horses. I mean, I heard a funny quote the other day. It said, "Please God, let me break even. I need the money." You know,
where did you hear that? That's brilliant. 000, that's brilliant stuff. Yeah.
When you start with 15,000, it is really hard to pull the trigger and be willing to lose all that money. If that's the case, I'm saying less than 50 can win.
Lesson number one to me is if we're talking about, you know, where the most of the money of the prize pool is in the top two slots, if you're not willing to do that, just talking in a game theory point of view, and I think you both had excellent reasons for not doing it, but if you're not willing to do it, you're fighting with one hand tied behind your back. I mean, one of the first lessons I learned about live bank play, and it's as true now as ever, is if you can't treat it like Monopoly money, it is a bit like taking a knife to a gunfight if we're talking about the top prize. We are running out of time. I have two more little notes that I want to get your guys' thoughts on. One of the things that really struck me and makes me come up with my low number for the amount of people who can win, and I'm not going to pick on anybody particularly. Folks can go through the plays if they want, but looking at some of those players in the top 10, Pat did a great job pointing out people who are way down the leaderboard who took shots that could have gotten them there. But there were a lot of people, even people betting a lot of money in the last race, who were drawing dead for the win, not making bets that were efficient enough to get them to the number that would win. That I found mind-boggling, to take that kind of risk without the ability to win the biggest prize. I found that to be a big mistake that I would really caution players against making. I'd much rather see, if you're not trying to win, you should be more conservative. But to be aggressive and still not have plays that, if hit, would have put you there, I would caution heavily against that. Pat, did you see much of that, or did you see any other mistakes towards the top of the leaderboard at the end that you'd want to talk about to help us close things out?
You know, I think I raised this topic on Twitter, and I showed the plays of Paul Kush, and Paul very graciously responded to that and found it. I didn't even tag him on Twitter, but he found it, and he was critical of his own play and said, you know, I learned a lot by playing this and knowing how I kind of need to do this in the future. But, you know, he had just missed a big hit on Belvoir Bay earlier in the day. He hit 30 for 31,000, could have had about 110,000 if he had spent maybe about $50 more and shifted some money from the show pool to the win pool. And then going into the Classic, he bet $2,900, $2,500 of it to show on higher power. So he had a chance to do some things differently, but I think it was a good learning experience for him, and I'm sure we'll see him again.
He's a good player.
There were a couple players in that mix who very clearly took their shots, and there were some who didn't. And I think the point that you just raised and that we've kind of discussed here is that, and this is the tough thing to model, as Benny was alluding to earlier, it's tough to think that, you know, you don't always know the motivations behind every particular player. Some of them are very happy just having finished fifth and would love the extra 40 grand on top of that. And maybe they didn't have that strong of an opinion. You know, one particular player that I would look at, Dennis Montoro, who went into the Classic, he was alive on a big double to Vino Rosso, so he had some money left, but he obviously didn't know that Vino was winning, and bet some small exactas to make a little bit more money. But was he in a position for the kill shot? No, not really. There was a David Wilkenfeld, who had succeeded very well early in the tournament. He had a ton of money going into the Classic. After hitting for 63 grand in the distaff, he only bet $4,000 on a cold exacta going into the Classic. So, you know, talk about having to be incredibly right and leaving a huge amount of money on the table. He certainly did do that. And again, you know, you don't know what all the motivations are. You can publish all the plays, but getting inside someone's head, that's a much tougher thing to do. So it's part of the reason why I think some of the outcomes of these are a little tougher to predict. And I think maybe the greatest thing about this discussion, Pete, is what you said earlier about Brad Anderson, that if he played a bit more efficiently and a bit more boldly in the Fillion Mare sprint, he may have lost the contest because it would have given him enough money. And that is a mind-boggling result. When you think about it, I'm sure when Brad thinks about it in that perspective, he'll look back and say, wow, maybe slightly misplaying this race is what allowed me to win it. And that's a very tough thing to predict going forward. Look, at the end of the day, it's a lot of fun. It's a tremendous experience. There are so much Monday morning quarterbacking you can do after it that makes it fun and engaging. And I look forward to it next year.
Very cool. One very quick thing, Benny, I'll give you like 30 seconds on this one. It's a topic that came up a bunch. The idea of wind-dutching a field to get minimums out of the way. My take on it is this. If you're going to use that type of strategy, this actually is something that happened in the tournament, and it's been talked about a lot on Twitter. For me, I don't hate the concept if you can throw out enough of the field to negate the takeout so that you're going to bet 600 and come out with 600 or more. I do not like it when you're betting it and you know 600 and you're betting literally every horse, and 600 if you're lucky is going to become 450. Your thought on that strategy very quickly, and then we're going to wrap this edition of the show because I got to record another one.
I'd rather chew glass than do it. I'd rather break up a bottle, make little shards of broken glass, and swallow everyone one by one. Here's an example. I'll be very brief. I threw 2,000 into doubles a couple years ago with Stormy Liberal in the sprint turf at Del Mar, and I got nothing back. Not only did I get nothing back, but I hedged against everybody that I didn't have in the field, with the exception of two horses. And I lost all my hedges. Not only did I lose my doubles with Stormy Liberal, I lost all my hedges. So these are horses, they make left turns on dirt and on turf. You never know what's going to happen. The idea of dutching something and throwing out two is a worse strategy, in my opinion, from personal experience, than just dutching them all. But it's a terrible idea.
The dutching, but just to clarify, you're not just saying the throwing out the two is a terrible idea. Though to you, wind dutching to get a minimum out of the way is a terrible idea.
It's a terrible idea. Play a 3-5 shot to show. You have a much better chance of getting your entire bankroll back plus a couple extra dollars. Then you're going to lose money.
All right. We've got to end this. This was a lot of fun. I want to thank Benny South Street. I want to thank Pat Cummings. I want to thank our sponsors for all of their support, all of them, but in particular, 10 Strike Racing, Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, Stats Race Lens. We really appreciate it. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening and making these shows so much fun to do. This show has been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas for Natal. May you win all your photos. Hey, everybody. Just wanted to give a word for our latest partner, Stats Race Lens. This is a product that is definitely worth checking out. You can even get discounts if you use the promo code STATSITM. We're talking about customizable PPs with comprehensive research abilities, video replays, advanced search and notifications, access to Stats True Odds, handicapping angles, and back testing. That's what Scott Coles used to help him win the NHC this year, and he's talked about on this show. It's mobile and tablet friendly. Stats Race Lens, bringing clarity to handicapping. And make sure you use the promo code STATSITM, STATSITM.